This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast featuring weekly interviews with the most brilliant minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is always free of charge, and unlike the mainstream financial press, we are not a platform for market cheerleading. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the business telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Macro Voices, Episode 6, was recorded on March 18th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. The last week has been a veritable hotbed of central bank meetings, with the European Central Bank meeting last week, the Fed's FOMC statement on Wednesday of this week, along with the press conference with Janet Yellen on Wednesday afternoon, and then, of course, Kuroda-san from the Bank of Japan speaking on Wednesday evening. With all the action in central bank policy this week, I told Nathan we needed a currency and central bank policy expert on the show this week. Nathan outdid himself, lining up Axel Merck of Merck Investments is this week's special guest. I'll be talking to Axel about the ECB, the Fed, the BOJ, the U.S. dollar rally, and much more.
And I'm Nathan Egger. Eric, before we even get into the stock market, please clear this up. So expectations were for the Fed not to change interest rates, and that's what happened. Yet everyone is saying the FOMC statement was more dovish than expected. So how is that possible? What's a dot plot, and what does forward guidance have to do with markets, from stocks to bonds to oil to gold jumping on the news?
There's actually a lot of information that's communicated in the FOMC statement after each one of these meetings. The big headline information, of course, is did they change interest rates? And that means interest rates here and now. Did they change the target rate for Fed funds as of this meeting? And that's what people tend to focus the most on. As expected, they didn't change anything in that regard. But there's a lot of other information in that statement. One of the things that comes out is called the dot plot. And the reason it's called the dot plot is essentially each of the members of the Federal Reserve. And it's important to understand, it's all of the members, not just the voting members. These guys are asked to imagine at various different times in the future what they think the federal funds rate is going to be in the future. And each one of them comes up with their estimate, and each governor's estimate is plotted as a dot on a chart. So you see on the dart this little cluster of dots that means that, okay, a bunch of governors all think this is going to be the interest rate. That dot plot effectively communicates the Fed's implied expectations about how many times it's going to hike rates in the future. In other words, if a typical federal bank rate hiking cycle is 25 basis points, and the Fed governors, who are the guys that get to decide what the policy is going to be, are currently estimating that rates are going to be 100 basis points higher than they are right now, 1 year from now, well, 25 basis points per hike, 100 basis points total, that tells you to expect 4 25 basis point hikes over the course of the next year. And that's what the Fed was telling us with these dot plots until now. What we got in this report was an indication that the governors have lowered their expectation for where they see interest rates a year out. Now they're 50 basis points instead of 100 basis points. Hey, wait a minute. That implies that what we can expect over the next year is only 2 Fed rate hikes instead of 4 Fed rate hikes. That was the unexpectedly dovish information that the Fed delivered this week. Is essentially they're saying, we're telling you not to expect as many rate hikes or as much of a hike in cumulative total in interest rates over the next year as we were telling you last month. We've changed our mind. Now we think it's half as much. That's what kind of shocked the market this week.
Okay, got it. All right, so on to equities. You've been bearish on the stock market for the last few weeks, but it keeps marching higher. Are you still bearish here post-Fed?
Well, you know, Nathan, my work centers on both fundamental analysis and technical analysis. I use fundamental analysis to understand the market and decide what trades I want to engage in. And then I use technical analysis for two purposes. One is to time the entries and exits to trades. The other is as a sanity check for my fundamental analysis. In other words, if the fundamental analysis is very bullish, but the chart is very bearish, well, then something doesn't add up. That sanity check aspect is definitely coming into play here, because as I look at the fundamental case for the stock market, nothing has changed. I think that we have not fixed any problems. The Fed is taking the punch bowl away. They've said they're not going to take it away quite as quickly, but they're still going to take it away. They have not yet made any intimations that we're really going to see a further easing cycle, such as negative interest rates or more quantitative easing. Now, I think those things are coming eventually, but they haven't shown those cards yet. For now, what they're telling us is what they're telling us. So I think at this point, if you look at this market from a technical analysis standpoint, you cannot ignore this breakout above the 200-day moving average. And that's why I said the sanity check comes into play here. My outlook is fundamentally still very bearish, but if I look at this chart, you know, I thought this rally was a short squeeze that was going to stop about 100 points ago at the 50-day moving average. We've taken out the 50-day, the 100-day, the 200-day, and we're still moving higher. Now, there is a lot of precedent, Nathan. If you have an unexpected event, as we had with this Fed meeting, sometimes there's a blow-off reaction to that. What will happen is markets will race higher for a day or two, and then it kind of wears off, and they'll go back to the downside. If my bearish thesis for stocks is going to be proven correct, it needs to happen pretty darn quickly here, because frankly, if we continue this breakout, which is now 2.5 days old above the 200-day moving average on the S&P 500. If that continues, really, if you look at it from a technical analysis standpoint, the next major target to look for in terms of another resistance level would be new all-time highs. So I think that the market needs to turn around. It is, on a technical level, awfully close to telling me that I'm wrong here and it's time to just give up on the short side of this trade. And in the interest of full disclosure, I am still short S&P 500 futures at a considerable loss at this point. I do think that it's possible that we're going to see the effect of the Fed meeting blow over and that markets will reverse to the downside. And I think that what will be particularly important for equities is crude oil. I think the reason equities have managed to break out here is because everybody is jumping for celebration, saying, oh boy, the rout in crude oil is finally over. The bottom is in. I don't think it's in. We'll get to crude oil in a minute. We need crude oil to prove me right here in order to pull the stock market back down. Otherwise, I think we're rapidly approaching the point where this equity rally could accelerate towards new all-time highs. That could pull oil even higher. Again, I don't think the fundamental case for either oil or equities is very strong. But if the technicals continue to show us a breakout, you've got to take it seriously at some point. And we're getting awfully close to that point where I have to throw in the towel, at least on my equity short.
Okay, let's cover recent developments in crude oil next, as it looks like we're testing another key resistance level here again late session on Thursday. Now, the pattern for the last month has been that every Wednesday, which is also EIA inventory day, we get one or more OPEC oil ministers spreading propaganda to jawbone the market higher. So what was this week's propaganda story of choice?
Well, the propaganda story of choice this week is still this production freeze meeting that they're still talking about. It played out a little bit differently, and I think at least this week we do have some mitigating fundamental factors that are legitimate that we need to talk about. So you had the propaganda campaign overnight session early morning on Wednesday before the inventory data came out, and that did help to move the market higher. But that inventory data coming out, it was a build on inventory, but it was only a 1-point-something million barrel build. We had a 10 million barrel build a couple of weeks ago. Expectations were for about a 3 million barrel build. So we had a smaller build on inventory nationally than expected. Cushing, Oklahoma inventory was still a build of more than 500,000 barrels, which I see as very significant because we're really getting close to running out of capacity in Cushing. But what you remember, Nathan, is I cautioned a couple weeks ago if this thing went past 36, it could easily turn into a self-reinforcing event on the technicals alone. In other words, it was the jawboning by the oil ministers that got us up above 36, 36 and a half. Then a whole bunch of stops kick in, and that gets the market going further. It becomes a self-reinforcing short squeeze. I said that if we got past 36, it could easily take us into the 40s. We're above 40 now, a 40 spot 20 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. There's technical resistance at about 40.50, then again at 42. I'd like to say that this can't go any further, but it's important to understand it can go further. When we get to 40.5, which is the next major milestone, you know they're going to be out with the next propaganda story trying to push the market past that technical milestone, get more technical traders on the bullish side of this trade. What it will take, ultimately, to reverse this is Art Berman and I being proven correct about the storage crisis. Now, 2 weeks ago, we had an inventory report that definitely proved that out. 10.5 million barrel inventory built. This week, we only saw 1.something million barrel inventory built in less than half of expectations. No surprise that the market risk has been to the upside as a result of that. I don't think the big inventory builds are over yet. I think we have more big builds on inventory and big builds on Cushing inventory coming. When we see that, that would be the catalyst to force the market down. In the meantime, it seems like sentiment is winning out. Everybody wants to just jump for celebration that there's going to be a meeting. I don't know what they're going to talk about at this meeting. There's really nothing relevant to talk about. It won't have anything to do with the oil market, but it definitely has a lot to do with affecting the prices in the oil market now before the meeting. So go figure. I think we're going to have to wait until the inventory numbers prove themselves to be what they are, and at that point, I think the market will be forced much lower. Will stocks already be at new highs before that happens in oil? I don't know.
We saw gold retest cycle highs late last week before correcting down towards 1230. Then gold got a $30 bump following the Fed statement. What's going to be moving gold in the near term? What should we expect?
Well, you know, I want to look at gold before the Fed statement. We were back down below 1230, high 1220s, and from the Fed statement, we did get a $30 plus bump. Look at what happened in the Fed statement. Gold bugs were just handed a gift horse on a silver platter. I'm not sure quite how a horse fits on a platter, but forgive the metaphor. What just happened is unexpectedly the Fed told us, hey, we're not going to hike rates half as much as we expected to. And remember, the whole argument for gold, or against gold, I should say, is gold doesn't produce any return. It doesn't generate any income, whereas treasury bonds do. People who think that treasury bonds are just as safe as gold, I would disagree with, but a lot of people think that. They prefer treasuries because they generate a yield. Gold can't generate a yield. What the Fed just told you is our plan to increase the yield on those U.S. dollar-denominated treasuries? Never mind, we didn't mean it. So that was about the best thing that gold possibly could have asked for. We didn't even get to new cycle highs on that news. We moved back up to where we were 3 or 4 days ago without even testing the cycle high. What that says to me is gold doesn't have the strength that a lot of people do. Now, on a technical basis, this breakout above the 200-day moving average is very real. It's very strong. But from the news we just got, I would expect it to propel much higher. It didn't do that. So I do think that the gold rally has run out of steam here. Is it just catching its breath and maybe going to correct a little bit to the downside and then take off again? I want to wait till we see new highs above 1280 before I really invest in trusting this rally.
So we've seen gold, crude, and equities all move higher post FOMC, but rather strangely, we saw bonds being bid as well. So what's going on here?
Well, I think that it's a reaction in the wake of the FOMC. What you just heard from the FOMC is what? We're not going to hike rates as much as we thought. What does that mean? Yields are going to be lower. Well, lower yields means higher bond prices. So bond prices are moving higher, yields are moving lower as an adjustment to move those prices in line with what the expectations that are coming from the Fed are now, because we were being told that interest rates were going to be a full percent higher a year from now. Now we're saying more like 0.5% higher. So it's, I think, a short-lived phenomenon that both stocks and bonds are moving in the same direction at the same time. And I think it's in the wake of the FOMC meeting. What I'm waiting for is the immediate effects of the FOMC meeting to wear off so we can see, is this market really going to get carried substantially higher from here? Or is this kind of a blow-off in reaction to unexpected dovish news from the FOMC, and the market's going to digest it and realize, okay, but it still doesn't really change anything? I think it's going to be the latter, but I've been wrong here for a few weeks, especially with respect to equities. So we'll see what happens.
Thank you for bringing us up to speed and sharing with us your market perspective, Eric. You've made it perfectly clear to us that central banks are what's driving the action this week, and we've got the perfect guy to help us make sense of it all. So let's move on to your interview with Axel Merk right after this.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now on the program is Axel Merk from Merk Investments. Axel runs a couple of currency mutual funds, and we brought Axel on the program this week because we've got so much central bank activity in the last week between the ECB meeting last week, some unexpected news from the Fed this week, and of course the Bank of Japan was the smaller central bank bit of news. Axel, let's start with the ECB and just do a review. I think a lot of people don't even understand exactly precisely what happened there. What did the ECB do? And what do you see as its consequence?
Yeah, that's a great question. Good to be with you. Well, Mr. Draghi, head of the ECB, threw in the kitchen sink. And he forgot that when you throw a kitchen sink, you need a PhD in plumbing in order to untangle things again. So he utterly confused some people. And then just after he had thrown in the kitchen sink, a few minutes into the press conference, he said, by the way, I'm not going to lower rates any further. And so if you hadn't been confused by then, you were utterly confused just after that. And ever since then, the euro appeared to be on an upward trajectory, because previously, until then, a key goal of Draghi's policy appeared to have been to weaken the euro. And the argument for that had been that it is done difficult to become more competitive by accepting lower wages. And so why not just make the eurozone more competitive? The problem with that was that it only helped the folks who are ready to export, meaning it helped Germany, but it didn't really sufficiently help countries like Italy and the southern countries. And so on the day when he held the press conference, he switched gears from focusing on trying to debase the euro to truly try to boost the banking sector. Remember, a key difference between central banking in the U.S. and the eurozone is in the U.S. we have a functioning credit market. And so you can like or dislike QE, but you kind of have an impact by attacking the credit markets. In Europe, most loans still go through the banking system. And so you've got to have healthy banks. And that's kind of difficult when you have this huge collection of different regulators and different states and so forth. And so while he says that the program that he initiated is going to be kind of a cash for funding type of program similar to what the UK had, in essence, what it first and foremost is, it's a way to cut the funding cost of European banks in half. And he does that with, we called it TLTRO II. It's the latest program where he basically allows people to refinance existing bank debt at 0%. And so with that, he can truly cover the cost of the funding cost of the banking system. And through that, you might get healthier banks, and through that, you might be able to boost spending. So it's a very change in tone, but in the process, he confused a lot of people.
Okay. And how would that work if you can refinance existing bank debt at zero interest? Doesn't that effectively rob the banks of all of their income sources if their customers can refinance without paying interest?
Well, it's the banks that can refinance. And it's a little bit more complicated than that. So it's a funding for lending scheme, and it's a scheme that's aimed at encouraging banks to increase loans to the non-financial private sector. It is a scheme where the banks can borrow at zero. Now, mind you, borrowing at zero is only fun if you can do something with the money, because if you have excess reserves, well, guess what? If you deposit those back at the ECB, you're currently paying minus 40 basis points, meaning minus 0.4%. So you're only going to get the cash, take the cash, if you have a project for it. And that's why I said the cash that's available, and there are certain limits as to how much is available, but the cash that is available is best used for the existing bank debt, because that one you can just swap out. And we did the math, and we come to kind of cutting the cost of the banking system in half. Now, beyond that, you need to have real projects, because otherwise you're going to pay more than what you get in cheap money from the ECB. And if you kind of do the math in fractional reserve banking, sure, they might use the project, but somebody's loan is going to end up at somebody else's deposit. So ultimately, somebody will have excess reserves. So somebody will be stuck with a minus 40 basis points. And the theory is that ultimately the ECB is not going to be fine with that. Now, one thing I forgot to mention, if these banks exceed certain parameters, the ECB will actually pay the banks to lend money. And that's where getting into territory where a few people are alleging that might not exactly be legal. So I'm sure the courts will have a word to say about it. But clearly, the ECB is trying very hard to get the banks to lend. Now, as magic a bazooka that Mr. Draghi may want to have, none of that fixes the ultimate problem that there might not be sufficient demand. There is probably a demand issue if credit is just about free and people are simply preferring to buy treasuries, German treasuries, with just about zero yield 10 years out, rather than invest in a long-term project. That problem Mr. Draghi has not fixed, and that's ultimately what's holding back Europe, and that's holding back the global economy.
So to summarize what's going on, at least on the European side of this, the ECB has come forward with an extremely accommodative package. But at the same time, in the next breath, Mario Draghi said that he's essentially never going to lower rates again, that this is as low as it gets. And that's adding some confusion. Why don't we move on to the Fed now? That also, I think, was a little bit of confusion. A lot of people were not expecting, and I think not understanding, what was coming out in the dot plots in terms of different forward guidance for future rate cuts.
Sure. Just one more word on the ECB. You said it right. Draghi said he's not going to lower rates further. Now, think about what that means. That means we have reached the bottom of the easing cycle in Europe. And that is one of the reasons why the euro reacted so strongly to it. Because usually it's the change in trend that gets people to act. Just like, look at the Fed. We have been told that the Fed is going to hike rates for years now. And so in that process, we have pushed up the dollar versus other currencies because there's going to be this great hiking cycle coming. Well, if and when it actually comes, as we have seen now, well, maybe there isn't so much of a hiking, such a dollar rally left to be done because so much quote-unquote good news, the change in trend has already been priced in. And so you talk about the dot charts that many economists look at. These are basically the projections that the various members of the FOMC make. And in my view, they should probably get rid of those altogether because they cause more confusion than anything else. You have everybody, including the folks who are not voting, make predictions. And you got to understand a little bit about the composition at the Fed. You have Janet Yellen, who's the chair, and everybody knows her. Then you kind of know the vice chair, that's Mr. Fisher. But then it very quickly gets to be not so clear anymore who it is. There are a couple of governors, and then there are a couple of regional Fed presidents. And the regional Fed presidents, historically, they are mostly some academics, and they tend to have various views. They like to debate, and some of them have more influence than others. But in many ways, it's a bit of a debating club, and they might have views that, oh, we think rates should be higher down the road. And so they put on these little tables that they get when they get their surveys. Rates are going to be higher. And they are human beings like anybody else. They're no smarter than the market is. And indeed, they're usually wrong. And so every time these dots change, everybody jumps up and down and says, oh my God, the effect got more dovish, the effect got more hawkish, and is trying to kind of evaluate that. I think what ultimately is far more important is what is the kind of the driver of the thinking of the Fed chair. And there we used to have Greenspan, then we had Bernanke, and we had Janet Yellen. And they have very different frameworks to think about the markets. And I think one has to kind of try to get into their shoes to try to think about what's going to happen rather than think about what this entire debating club is up to. And when it comes to Janet Yellen, the important thing to remember is that she is a labor economist. One of the first the first speech she gave as a Fed chair that was directed at policy was about the labor market, and then she profiled, amongst others, three unemployed people. Two of them, and then she lamented how Fed policy hasn't been able to get those folks jobs. And two of those folks were convicted felons. And I cynically then commented, well, you don't have to look at any other indicators than to try to track down these two people, the convicted felons. If they have a job, rates are going to go up. And, of course, that's maybe a bit oversimplistic to say it, but the point here is, whereas Bernanke used to look at things like inflation expectations very, very closely, the thing that Janet Yellen looks at most closely is the labor market. And the key difference between looking at inflation expectations and the labor market is that Mr. Bernanke had a forward-looking indicator and Janet Yellen has a backward-looking indicator. The labor data are always stale. And that is why you have this environment in the market where it appears that the tail is wagging the dog. Whenever the market behaves, we think rates are going to go up, and then the market acts up, and expectations about the rate hike go down. It's because the Yellen Fed has made itself a slave to the markets, and that's what we've been seeing unfolding.
Now, skeptics of Fed policy, myself included, have said, look, we haven't really solved any of the problems since 2009. We've papered over our problems by printing more money, but we haven't solved the problem of too much debt. And a lot of us are kind of cynically questioning, are we really going to even see these four rate hikes that the Fed was talking about, or are they going to reverse course first into a QE4 or negative interest rates or some other form of dramatic easing? Where do you stand on that, Axel? Would you agree with the view that I hold, that there's a significant risk that they never get their four rates and they end up with QE4 first, or do you think that they're going to stay the course in terms of what they announced?
A couple of things. First of all, I agree that the policies we've had have not worked. We would not be at near zero rates years after the outbreak of the financial crisis if those policies were working. Now, again, Janet Yellen is looking in the rearview mirror. And that means you have to think about an ocean freighter that is on a set course. She has her thing. She has her model. And she is much less sensitive to things that are happening where I mentioned inflation expectations in particular, certain things that are happening out there. And so she's going to noodle around with what she wants to do, and then she's going to be surprised that the market is going to react a little bit differently, and then she'll react to it. And so if you think about it from a where rates are going to be, obviously she said, oh, we got to raise early, we got to be ahead of the game. What Janet Yellen is underestimating, in my view, is that we've based this recovery on asset price inflation. And asset prices were inflated through QE. What QE does, it compresses risk premium. It takes fear out of the market. By buying government securities, you're lowering the cost of credit, and it has an impact from everything from lowering the yields of junk bonds, but it also has the impact that it lowers the volatility in the equity markets. And so as the Fed is shifting towards pursuing an exit, what's happening is these risk premia are rising again. And that means that the junk bonds are going to yield more again, and that means volatility in the stock market is going to be higher. Well, everything else equal, when volatility in the stock market is higher, prices are lower. And that means we will be getting headwinds towards asset prices. So just as the Fed inflated asset prices, an exit is deflating asset prices. And that is why as the Fed is trying to have rates go higher, they're getting surprised that the headwinds in the economy are increasing. And the reason why the headwinds in the economy are increasing is because, again, because we've raised the recovery and asset price inflation. So raising rates lowers asset prices, and you're going to have a much bigger impact on a small rate hike than they expected. And that is a key reason why I agree with you. I don't think the Fed can hike rates as much as they wanted to. We have an economy that's slowing down. They might have to raise rates, and it's got a very negative impact on various assets. Now, the reason I kind of gave this example on the ocean freighter is because I'm not so sure that the Fed is going to recognize that on time. And so they might do one or two more rate hikes than many people think is plausible based on how markets react. And so we'll have to wait and see. I actually thought that Janet Yellen in the most recent FOMC press conference would be a tad more hawkish because the markets have been quiet, and she would say, yep, we're not going to raise rates, but we're out there watching. Whereas kind of what she said is, we're not going to raise rates, and by the way, we're going to keep rates lower, and we give you all kinds of reasons why we're not going to raise rates for the time being.
Now, one of the criticisms that I've seen of this action just in the last 24 hours is a lot of people have said, Janet Yellen has told us that this is not about levitating asset markets. It's not about saving the stock market. It's all about the real economy. But if you listen to everything they've said, they should have hiked rates at this. You know, according to the data that they're working from, they've got their unemployment, at least according to the numbers that they follow, at the number they wanted at. They've got inflation expectations moving higher now. What would you say to that criticism? Do you think that this action proved that Janet Yellen is essentially afraid to shock the markets? Because it would appear that asset markets are the only reason not for hiking at this most recent meeting.
Well, again, Janet Yellen's framework is the labor market, so she doesn't like the explanation that asset prices dictate the tone. But it doesn't change the fact that Greenspan talked a great deal about the wealth effect. Under the Bernanke Fed, in the minutes of the Feds, it frequently referred to asset prices. And once you start referring to asset prices in your discussions, then the Fed becomes responsible for asset prices. And yes, that has continued with the Yellen Fed. So she may not like it. In a perfect theoretical model, the asset prices shouldn't matter. But in practice, they do matter. And they have mattered in recent years. And so anything else is revisionist history. Just as she said a couple of other things that she said, for example, every meeting is a live meeting. And if there were credibility in the Fed, the market should have reacted to that quite strongly. Instead, they just ignored it because everybody kind of knows that, no, not every meeting is a live meeting. In Europe, we had Mr. Trichet, the predecessor to Draghi, always say, we are not pre-committed. And Draghi has thrown that out and given calendar deadlines and all kinds of things to say, hell yes, we're pre-committed. We want to keep these rates low. So they'll say whatever they need to say for the moment. And that works for a little while, but at some point, the public will say, yeah, you can tell us whatever you want, but we care about more what we do. And so these extraordinary policies, they have, one of the key things they have done is they have weakened the influence now of central banks because the market is calling the bluff. And Draghi recognized that, saying, hey, we can't take rates much lower. Banks are screaming that they can't cope with these negative rates because, by the way, if they pass on those negative rates to retail, they take the money out in cash. And so they have to do other things. In Switzerland, mortgage rates have gone up despite the negative rates. It's because the banks have to recoup the negative margin that they're eating. They can't charge their customers negative rates, and so they're hiking other rates. And so all these things become counterproductive. And what we have at the Fed is that they've told themselves, hey, we are through this. We can have an exit. We are better than everybody else. And yes, we're going to hike rates. And in the meantime, the market tells them, hey, not so fast, because, as you pointed out, we haven't fixed our own problems either. And let me just kind of round out here with another comment. Government debt has increased quite substantially, not just in the U.S., not just in the Eurozone, not just in Japan, in many places around the world. And if you are in an environment where government debt is very high, the interests of the government not aligned with the interests of investors. The government has an incentive to debase the value of that debt. That is why they want to have inflation. You, as somebody who's saving, has an interest in preserving the purchasing power of what you have earned. And so don't count on your government to help you out on this. You're on your own, and you have to find a way to try to retain purchasing power or increase, obviously, what you have, the purchasing power of what you have, despite government policy, rather than with government policy. And so it's just something to keep in mind as one watches these policymakers throughout the world in an environment where governments have too much debt.
Now, I want to come back and talk about some of the consequences and implications of all this Fed policy in a minute. But there was also a BOJ press conference last night where Kuroda-san spoke. What's your perspective on that?
Well, Mr. Kuroda is highly unpredictable. I just leave it at that. And first thing, when we look at the yen, when we were quite negative on the yen for a while. Well, we still have a long-term price target for the yen of infinity, meaning we think that the yen cannot survive it. And by the way, the worst thing that can happen to the Japanese is that the policies are working. I say worst thing because at that stage, the bond prices should fall and it should become impossible to finance government debt. But having said that, when Abe came to power, we said that as Abenomics is working, we should see a deterioration of the current account surplus that Japan had. We should see a weakening of the yen. And then if you look at the correlation between the yen and the S&P, for example, many people may be aware that the yen tends to rally when the S&P is down. In 2008, the yen actually was the best performing currency. It wasn't the dollar. The dollar did very well versus most everything, but the yen was up almost 20% or so versus the dollar that year. And the flight to safety was to the yen. And as Abenomics was working, the yen started to lose that safe haven appeal. The current account surplus eroded, and as that had eroded, the safe haven appeal evaporated, so to speak, and the yen behaved like just about any other currency. And then in late last year, we said we are very negative on equity markets, and we also believe that Abenomics has kind of run its course. It's not particularly effective, and so while we continue to have a very negative long-term outlook of the yen, we're taking that off the table, and we actually then in December said we're going to buy the yen because we think that the safe haven appeal is coming back to the Japanese. And I give all of that background. It's because obviously Kuroda is part of Abenomics. That's the Bank of Japan part of it, is that to what extent can the Bank of Japan print sufficient money, have enough influence on the markets to weaken the yen? And we saw a couple of weeks ago where the Japanese introduced negative rates and instead the yen rallied. And it just showed how ineffective the policy is. Now, that doesn't mean you can rule out central bankers, because obviously they control the bazooka. They can always come up with yet another scheme. But the main thing that the Japanese have achieved is to destroy liquidity in their markets. They've pretty much destroyed the JGB market, and it's very difficult to trade many things in Japan because the Bank of Japan is gobbling everything up. And so, yes, they'll live for another day, but for the time being and the environment that I foresee, the Bank of Japan has become a sideshow, just like Mr. Draghi has made himself a sideshow in the Eurozone. And it appears that Janet Yellen is on the way of making herself a sideshow, which is a good thing, by the way, if they are not going to be in command. But maybe the market is going to take an upper hand at some point again.
I have to chuckle. It does feel like we're talking about a three-ring circus here when we talk about the ECB and the Fed and the BOJ. Let's try to pull this all together now. I think one of the biggest trends in global macro for the last few years, almost everyone agrees, is the dollar rally. The U.S. dollar has been rallying very strongly since the beginning of 2014. And a lot of people are beginning to very hotly debate, is it over yet? Is it done? Does it have more to go, or is it ready to reverse? And something I've noticed, Axel, is people will get into hot debates about this and then realize they're talking past each other because the two guys talking had completely different concepts of what had caused this big rally in the dollar. So I'd like to start with your perspective. Let's set the Wayback Machine to the end of 2013. Quantitative easing is being tapered. They're winding down the QE program. All of a sudden, the dollar takes off, surprising a lot of people. What happened and why? How did we get to where we are now? And once we've covered that, what's your perspective? Has this thing got further to go, or is the dollar rally done?
I think that the two drivers that I would point to that not everybody else is talking about, and one of them is that if you look at the dollar rally we had until last summer in particular, so for 18 months or 3 years or so, the dollar had been rallying when the S&P has been rallying. And the reason why that is relevant and why I mentioned that instead of interest rate differentials right now is because that's not supposed to happen. Everybody in 2008 learned that in a flight to safety and when risk is off, that when the S&P is down, that's the environment where the dollar is supposed to be rallying. And rather than the other way around, that when risk is on, the dollar is supposed to be rallying. And the reason that was happening is because the Europeans had lowered interest rates so much that the euro was used as a funding currency for the so-called carry trade. You borrow cheaply, you borrow in euros, and you buy the high-yielding currency. The dollar had become a high-yielding currency. And so that's unusual, because usually the dollar is not a high-yielding currency in a quote-unquote normal environment. And that means the currency dynamics change. And so when risk is on, the dollar has been rallying. But it conversely, of course, means that when risk is off, the dollar tends to be under pressure. And some of the most dramatic risk-off days we've had in recent months, the dollar has plunged and the euro has skyrocketed in those days. And so when we talk about the dollar, of course, we have to think about, well, which currencies do we talk about? The dollar index has a huge overweight versus the euro. Then there is a trade-weighted index that the Federal Reserve is watching, which has a much bigger weighting towards emerging markets. Now, the difference, the key difference between emerging markets and the developed markets is that emerging market currencies tend to be tightly managed, and they tend to be much more driven by liquidity. And so in those markets, when risk is on, money flows into those currencies, and when risk is off, money flows out of those currencies. Now, if you put that together, since last summer, the markets has had a couple of hiccups. I talked about risk premia earlier. Risk premia are rising again. Equity prices have been coming down. We haven't been able to reach new highs in the S&P. In that sort of environment, the dollar has been under pressure. Now, emerging market currencies have continued to plunge, and indeed, Janet Yellen looks more at the trade-weighted index and has said, even as of a few weeks ago, oh, the dollar has continued to rise, whereas versus the euro and the dollar index, it had actually plunged. It's just that the Fed dollar index that they are watching, that the dollar had continued to rise because of that heavy component of emerging markets. And so just looking forward, if indeed we're going to have an environment where equity prices are going to be under pressure, I think from that point of view, the dollar might be under pressure as well. Now, going back to kind of the more traditional way of looking at currencies, if you look at interest rate differentials, we've been told for years, as I mentioned earlier, that yes, rates in the U.S. are going to go through the roof. In the rest of the world, they're going to go down to deeply negative territory. Well, the real world isn't black and white. It's more tones of gray. And sure enough, the Fed, we talked about the dot charts earlier, hiking expectations have been trimmed down. And conversely, Mr. Draghi said, we've reached the bottom. In fact, it's not just Mr. Draghi. If you look at Sweden, which I think is the most extreme example, in Sweden, you have good GDP growth, and you have very low unemployment. Most recent unemployment data were a tad worse than expected, but generally speaking, very good unemployment numbers. And the only thing that's quote-unquote wrong is inflation is low. Well, in practice, the Riksbank, the central bank in Sweden, is paranoid about the Swedish krona outperforming the euro, and they have taken rates deeply into negative territory, utterly inappropriate for the situation they're in, and they'll have to do a U-turn. That's the main implication. The Swedes will have to do a U-turn. Draghi has said they've bottomed out. Other central banks, the Swiss National Bank, Mr. Jordan, has said that you cannot take rates down forever. Norway just came out and said that, yes, we can do negative rates, but by the way, it would take a lot for us to go negative. And in Australia and New Zealand, they have said that there's a limit. And by the way, in Australia, you have a governor who's retiring in the fall. He wants to go down in the books as the one who hasn't caved in, who has kept Australia or the Australian dollar to be a quote-unquote normal currency. We're not going to go to zero, and we're not going to follow any of this stuff. And so you have this wave now of other countries that have had enough. Maybe not necessarily willingly, but because it's just not effective anymore. And then you have a Fed who says that, oh, by the way, we might not be able to raise rates as much. And then I am one somebody who says, well, we're even going to do less than what you think, Madam Yellen. And so you're creating an environment where maybe the dollar rally is overdone. And then let me give you a third reason. If you just look at the very simple technical thing, if you look at the long-term moving average of the dollar index, and if you and then you look at deviation bands, we are way out of whack, significantly above two standard deviations on the dollar index, even more so on the Fed-weighted dollar index, to an extreme that the dollar is above the trend line. And so there is, I think, the odds are favoring that we're going to come back to the average, which would be a fairly significant plunge in the dollar. And so for all those reasons, I think that this dollar rally is very, very long in the tooth.
So let's assume that you're right, for sake of argument, and the dollar rally is either ending or about to end or something like that. What are the implications for investors? What does that mean? I would assume that in terms of earnings and so forth, you know, is this positive, negative? What should investors conclude from your call that the dollar rally may have ended?
Yeah, so a couple of things. First of all, maybe first on the economic side, the inflation numbers are picking up because the dollar rally had been so strong, and so we had year-over-year dollar rallies of 20% range. I'm lowering the year-over-year cost of imports. Now that's fizzling out. Now the year-over-year comparisons for the dollar index are pretty flat, which means that inflation numbers are picking up, which means that actually Janet Yellen might be inclined to hike rates a little bit more. So that's that as a background. But what it means for corporate America, well, corporate America is more interested in the price level. They are still absorbing this dollar. That's not going to evaporate simply if the dollar is going to weaken from here onward. They're still struggling with the implications of the very substantial rally that we've had. And so there's going to be no benefit from a weaker dollar at this stage. We can talk about that in a year from now, maybe. But historically, I think more importantly, historically, companies have been trying to hedge themselves. Those hedges have run out because it's been happening for too long. And so corporate America is rather confused, and they've been trying to deal with more natural hedges. Now, what does it mean for the market in general? I kind of phrased it the other way around first. I said, because the markets are going to be weak, the dollar is also going to be weak. And the reason I went down that route is because of my view that as the Fed is trying to extricate itself from these policies, and I'm not suggesting they'll hike significantly, but as they're going down this path, risk premia are going to expand. And that is inducing volatility. And because the dollar has been rallying in a risk-off environment, that should be bad news for the dollar. And so what it basically means is that risk assets in general, together with the dollar, should be under pressure. And the problem for investors, of course, is where on earth do you hide? Because if, quote-unquote, everything has been going up, junk bonds, equities, all kinds of things, where do you go? And if you go to treasuries, the dollar is also going to be under pressure. And so there is really no easy answer. The textbook answer is you want to go to somewhere where you can generate a return stream that has a low correlation to the risky portion in your portfolio. That's why historically people invest in bonds. I just happen to not like bonds either, and I don't like the dollar either. And so you can do something in the space of currencies. You can buy a managed basket of currencies. I happen to also like long-short strategies in the currency market. You can do that very nicely, where by design you create an uncorrelated return stream. For say, if you buy the Australian dollar but sell the New Zealand dollar, that's not an investment recommendation, but then the return stream you generate is almost certainly not correlated to anything else one holds in the portfolio. If that's too complex, one can look at gold. Gold historically has a very low correlation to other asset prices. It's simple to understand. For full disclosure, we do have a gold ETF as well. But beyond that, you've got to look at long-short equity strategies or some other possibly more exotic strategy. The challenge is that if you look into the truly alternative universe, many of these strategies have not performed particularly well during the good times. And that will make it quite difficult to pick the right investment, but that's exactly where investors need to look. They need to make sure if it's an active product rather than something like gold, that the investment process is a sound one that's behind it. But the dollar, in my view, has a very good chance of weakening from here out, and that has implications for other asset prices, and I don't think that they're very positive, those implications.
Well, and certainly the people that are still bearish on gold have been citing the rally in the U.S. dollar as one of their biggest arguments for why to be bearish on gold. So if you think the U.S. dollar rally is over, presumably it's time to turn bullish on gold, and it sounds like you are. Let's move on to equities. I'm assuming that if you're saying that the dollar has been weak at times when equities have been weak, that tends to reinforce the hypothesis a lot of people have that this is about international capital flows, that the reason the U.S. stock market has been so strong is because the dollar has been strong. That results in international investors saying, if I invest in the United States, I get a double whammy. I get the upside on the S&P, but I also get the upside on the currency for being invested in the dollar. If that hypothesis is correct, then it sounds like maybe that is all starting to unwind. If the dollar is not going to be strong, international investors are not going to have that extra kicker for being in the dollar at the same time as being in the S&P. That gets them out of the S&P and out of the dollar, and it now becomes a self-reinforcing unwind process in the other direction. Is that something that you see on the horizon?
It's one of the components, but it's really just an attribute of the bigger picture why we believe equity prices might move lower. But to add into that, one of the changes that's been happening is that sovereign wealth funds now may have to sell their assets because many of the sovereign wealth funds are by oil-producing nations, and they have big, deep budget holes that they have to fill back home. Now, mind you, the Bank of Japan has been buying some foreign equities as well. But still, yes, I would agree with you. Talking anecdotally to advisors in Europe, we see that they have loved the U.S. because everything is, of course, right in the U.S. and everything is bad in the rest of the world. And so they have been piling money into the U.S. precisely on the back of what you've been saying. But of course, everything is a question of price. And so if you look at the fundamentals in the U.S., the earnings momentum has been stalling. Companies are not meeting their revenue targets. The stronger dollar has made the foreign earnings look weaker. And then importantly, I think that's at least important as the foreign falls, the foreign flows, is buybacks. Buybacks is kind of QE for stocks. And in recent weeks, buybacks have picked up a little bit again. But still, buybacks are less attractive when rates go up. And so those will fizzle out. Also, if you think about it, let's assume that I'm right, that Yellen Fed is going to be slow in doing whatever it's going to do and possibly stay on this course, try to hike a little bit. Earnings are going to go down because the dollar has been stronger, and I don't think they're going to get kind of the opposite of that anytime soon. So they'll have some challenges. The high interest rates make buybacks less attractive. And at the same time, if you think about, well, you're going to pay out a dividend or you're going to pay your bondholders, well, of course, they're going to pay the bondholders first. And so there's less money for shareholders around. So that's another headwind that's going to be there. And then just on a number of other factors, I also think that the U.S. market is tired. I don't buy the argument that kind of there's the based on certain valuation metrics, prices can go up by X percent. Whenever a Wall Street analyst doesn't know what to say, they'll tell you stock prices will go up 10%. If somebody tells you something moves by 10%, they have no clue what they're talking about. That's kind of my reaction usually. It's the expansion of risk premium, in my view, that's going to be headwind to equity prices. And yes, it is ultimately that money is then going to flow back to some of the countries where it originated from. Mind you, that some of these investors will be slower to react than others. And maybe a big factor we haven't talked about, which is maybe the biggest factor of all, is the American investor, both institutional and retail. Think about what happens when prices go up and up and up and volatility is low. Well, guess what? You've got to be thinking that nothing can possibly go wrong. We talked to advisors over and over again who told us that they were getting out of low-risk assets into equities because their investors wanted them to do it. They were afraid of missing out on the rallies. People bought the dips. And so what that tells me is that investors are overexposed to risk assets. What that also means is that as volatility flares up, investors say, hey, I haven't signed up for that. And that the sentiment is changing. And it's not changing overnight. It's happening gradually over time. It's going to take months for that to play out, where people say, oh, maybe I'm more interested in capital preservation. And if you take a company like Apple, and I'm not giving an investment recommendation on Apple here, everybody in quotes already owns Apple. If you want to diversify, you've got to sell Apple. It doesn't mean whether their sales are going to be great or horrible. You've got to diversify, and Apple is going to be one of the companies you're going to sell. And that's why the so-called FANG stocks have been very top-heavy, and they look like they're toppling over. And so all of these things are ultimately drivers for low equity prices. I happen to think that's going to be associated with a weaker dollar.
The people that think that the U.S. Treasury yield is headed lower usually cite their belief in an ongoing or a continuing bull market in the U.S. dollar as the reason for why that's going to be true. I would assume that if you feel that the U.S. dollar rally is either over or almost over, you probably think that either the bottom is in yields or is almost in. So is it time to short treasuries? And if it's not time in the United States yet, what about Europe, where the German Bund is now deeply into negative territory, well beyond 10 years out on the maturity curve?
Well, I should probably leave that to smarter minds, because I don't think anybody has been able to predict that the 10-year in most countries accurately for an extended period. When rates are a little bit higher, shorting treasuries can be very expensive. Now, clearly, when rates are negative, it becomes cheap. It becomes profitable to short the 10-year. So maybe it is something worth considering. If you have a weakening equity market, treasuries tend to rise. In Europe, we see a Japanification, so to speak, of the markets, where central banks have been kind of pressing down on those yields and locking us in there. At some point, that game is going to backfire. But I'm not in a position when that's going to happen. To me, the 10-year in particular is a game that's too risky to play. I don't touch the 10-year with a broomstick, but it also means I'm not going to short it. I'd rather play it elsewhere. I'd rather play it in the currency sphere or elsewhere. And of course, conversely, though, of course, one does look at things like the spreads between the 10-year in the U.S. and other countries, and there's still a big yield differential. And so those sort of yield differentials do entice certain foreign investors to engage in certain types of trades. So, yes, we look at that. But I would not give an investment recommendation on a 10-year because it's just a very, very difficult game to play. And you have lots of people littered the streets who have been wrong with those predictions.
Axel, you recently did a Black Swans webinar where you talked a lot about tail risks that could affect us in the market. Could you give our listeners just an overview of what you covered in that webinar?
It's a webinar that's coming up on March 23, and if you're listening to this recording after March 23, we do have a monthly webinar, and we try to cover interesting topics, discuss what's happening in the market's implications. The Black Swan webinar is focusing on what can possibly go wrong, right, and on the sort of risk that investors might not be thinking about. And so I've given you kind of lots of ideas, and I hope I've given you some ideas that you don't hear from too many other people. The reason why we tend to have those sort of ideas that you don't hear everywhere else is because, quite frankly, we don't listen to too many other people. We actually do our bottom-up research ourselves. We go to the sources. We go to central banks. We listen to their speeches. Now everybody's familiar. You can do that at the Fed as well. You've been able to do that at the ECB for many years already. We try to go to the original context of how things have been said, and you can do that when you have an international team that can kind of help to interpret what these guys might be up to. And so that's how we devise our views and the theories. Now, if you want to learn more about the webinar, you can come to our website at merckinvestments.com, and there's a button to sign up for it.
I also want to cover your newsletter, because I know you do an excellent newsletter, and it's little advice I just want to leave with our listeners. Even if you are, let's say, a stock trader and you don't follow currencies at all, if you want to understand the big macro picture of what's going on in the world, following currencies, even if you're not trading them directly, is just so valuable in terms of understanding the overall big picture of what's happening in the world. Axel has one of very few currency newsletters that you can get for free. Axel, please tell them where they can find it.
Sure. The easiest place to go to is, again, merckinvestments.com. There's a button to sign up for a newsletter. And we do cover currencies, but we don't cover them from a trading strategy point of view. So we're not going to tell you the latest Fibonacci numbers or things like that. But instead, we tend to focus on the big picture analysis, similar to what I gave you right now, and help people to understand the dynamics. In my view, there's nothing worse than chasing the news and just doing something because something just popped up in the news. You got to have your framework to think about the world, and then as the news flow happens, you got to put it in the context of your framework, and that's when you can make a buy or sell decision on anything, including currencies or equities or whatever it might be. And so we try to help people to develop that sort of framework to think about the global dynamics, which I believe are very, very firmly influencing just about everything these days. And so, yes, again, on our website, merckinvestments.com, there's a link to sign up for our newsletter, and I appreciate anybody who would like to join it.
Well, Axel, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Nathan Egger and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
So, Eric, we have a Fed who says rate hikes are not off the table, despite surprising markets with an unexpectedly dovish rate hike guidance revision this week. Now, for the past 6 to 7 years, we have gotten used to equity markets rallying when the Fed turns more dovish than expected. But Axel is making a much different case. Can you clarify for us exactly why he is suggesting that this time is different?
Well, I think it's a number of factors. Let's sort of start with the big picture. If central banks conjure money out of thin air because they need to in order to support asset markets that are crashing otherwise, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, you could look at it and say it's an act of desperation. It indicates that things are so bad that even though this printed money is being thrown at the problem, we know it's not a real solution. It can't solve anything. It's not going to fix anything. It won't work. A lot of people, including myself, took that view in the grand scheme of things back in early 2009, and we were wrong. What was proven is that if you conjure money out of thin air, it has to go somewhere. Now, I still think that it's not solving any problem in the long term, but it certainly, in the short term, has supported asset markets, and it supported asset markets very effectively. There comes a point, though, when the market recognizes, hey, these guys are just running out of options. They're rapidly running out of ammunition. They're trying everything they got left, and they're quickly running out of options. We're going to get to the point here where the market has to stand on its own legs without relying on the central bank for support. And I think that's what Axel was alluding to, is we're getting to the point here where the stock market's going to have to be able to support itself on organic economic growth without central banks printing money to throw at it, or markets are eventually going to revolt with a loss of confidence. So it's that loss of confidence in central banks moment that, you know, I think is 5 years overdue, frankly, but it hasn't happened yet. And I think what Axel is suggesting is that maybe we're getting closer to it.
Okay. Those who follow us here at Macro Voices will know that a lot of the work that you do focuses on the commodity complex, specifically crude oil, and that you've maintained a bearish stance on oil fundamentals despite us seeing prices continue to rally. Now, let's assume Axel is proven right and we see this dollar rally fade and we see a weaker stock market. Is this going to change your views on oil in any material way?
No, Nathan, I don't think it changes my outlook in any way in the long term. What it does do is it forces me to put my seatbelt on, because being short crude oil futures, with the Fed doing what the Fed just did, they basically said, look, with respect to these next four rate hikes that we promised you guys, we were only kidding, you're only going to get two of them. So that's extremely negative for the dollar index, therefore positive for everything denominated in dollars, including commodities such as oil. I think most of that effect has already been felt. It was a big shock. We didn't think this was coming. It spiked the dollar index down. It spiked oil up as a result. I don't expect anything that the Fed did to cause a trend that's going to continue for months to come. To the contrary, I think that we just got this shock. Everybody had a wake up. Probably what we've seen is an overshoot of the effect of this, and it'll start to revert towards the mean. So, yes, I definitely think that it is possible that the Fed, well, I'm certain that the $2 move up in crude oil prices this week is a result of Fed action. Is that going to continue? It very well could, but I don't think it's going to have a long-term effect on crude or any other commodities.
Okay, so if we know that too much supply has been the most important factor in the unbalanced crude oil market, but it is demand that continues to trouble central bankers and limit economic growth in the global economy. Draghi said last week that interest rates will not be lowered any further, and the ECB seems to be doing all they can, well, within their mandate, to spur banks to lend, but the demand just isn't there. If we try for a moment to make an optimistic case for the European and global economies, can you identify any scenarios where we might start to see a material pickup in the demand for capital?
Well, it's a pretty ugly picture. You know, I think that in the grand scheme of things, we are coming up on the end of a long, long cycle. Long, long, long cycle. And that cycle is the one in which we've gotten used to just borrowing and spending, spending on borrowed money, living beyond our means. And it's not just a question of individuals, it's a question of the policies of governments. There was a time that I can remember when governments tried to instill financial responsibility into their citizens. After the Great Depression, there were actually, you know, signs up on street corners encouraging people, put a little bit of money away for a rainy day, have some savings, be ready, don't spend beyond your means, debt is not your friend. These were the kind of things that we tried to teach people in society. These days, we've gotten to the point where the government is so desperate to try to stimulate the economy somehow, by hook or by crook, that they're actually encouraging reckless and irresponsible behavior. What can we do to get people spending? What if we were to give them some kind of special benefit card that it expires if you don't spend it by midnight so that they'll have to spend the money? What can we do to force people through negative interest rates into spending more of their money and not saving it? We're trying to punish savings in order to address a short-term problem. I think eventually what this leads to is a reset, a blow-up point, where we recognize that we have borrowed and spent beyond our means for too long, and debt is excessive at every level, at a personal level, at a government level, at a corporate level, and it's a huge, huge problem. So I don't really see this leading, you know, the way you pose the question is, does this lead to a positive scenario in demand for capital? I don't know what happens in the short term, but I think in the long term, eventually, we've got to reconcile the fact that we've reached the point where governments are so desperate to stimulate the economy that they are encouraging reckless and irresponsible behavior among the citizens. We've actually got the citizens revolting against the government, saying, no, I'm not going to be reckless and irresponsible with my money like my government is actively encouraging me to do. I'm going to be responsible and save it instead. It's just amazing to me that we've seen an absolute reversal of public sentiment since I was a kid, but it doesn't seem to register as a big issue for most people.
And we are seeing those savings rates begin to tick up. Maybe people are getting the message behind the message that we're going to have to reel it in and be more responsible at some point. So those who have followed your work since before we started Macro Voices will know very well that you've been saying since Janet Yellen was appointed Fed chair, that we would be seeing a pronounced shift in the focus of the Fed. You explained that Janet Yellen would be focusing more on the labor market and Main Street and less on inflation statistics and Wall Street. You suggested that we may be more likely to see some form of direct Main Street stimulus or helicopter money. We're more likely to see that than another round of QE like we've seen in the past. It appears to me that you were largely correct, at least in your perceptions of Chair Yellen. And now we see the Fed hitting their unemployment target. They still seem to be sort of chickening out on normalizing rates. So what do you think is causing this backtracking out of the Yellen Fed?
Well, the backtracking and the chickening out, I'm convinced that what we're seeing finally in this meeting is Janet's kind of been shown for what she really is. She's been telling this story about how it's not to support Wall Street, it's not to support asset markets, and so forth. I do believe that Janet, personally, is much more oriented towards stimulus for the economy for the benefit of the people rather than for Wall Street. I think that Janet is very much on board with that. But I think she also understands that in this environment, the Fed's got to save the stock market, otherwise it's going to really fall over and crash here. And I think, you know, it's one of the questions that I posed to Axel. How is it possible that they didn't hike here? Because if you go by what the Fed has told us in the past, they should have hiked at this meeting. Why didn't they? There's really no big reason not to in the Main Street economy. There's a lot of reasons in Wall Street markets not to right here. And I think that's what spooked them out of it.
One of the other things that you and Axel discussed was this topic of quantitative easing, and in particular, the prospect of more of it from the Federal Reserve before this is over. Would you expect that to look like the last three major rounds of quantitative easing? You are saying that you do expect further stimulus eventually. Or do you expect more of the so-called helicopter money or QE for the people that some have discussed?
Well, I'd like to broaden your question a little bit and put it another way. A lot of investors are expecting that there's going to be another round of quantitative easing. I agree with them. I think there's more QE coming. Almost everybody is assuming, yeah, we know what that looks like. We've been there before. The Fed prints up a whole bunch of money, and they basically give it to banks. They use it to buy treasury bonds. The primary dealers end up front-running those trades. Everybody on Wall Street makes a lot of money on this. Supposedly, it was going to help Main Street. It didn't really help Main Street. I think that there will be more quantitative easing, that there will be more demands that the Fed support the economy through printing money. But I don't think that it's going to go to Wall Street next time. I think that both politicians and the Main Street populace are going to stand up and say, no, we want helicopter money. If we're going to print more money, don't send it to Wall Street bankers. Send it to us. Give it to the people. Let us go out and buy McDonald's with it or whatever and support the economy that way. Now, I don't think that makes any sense for the economy. I don't think it's an intelligent way to try to solve the problem. But I think it's very likely the way that the public policy discussion is going to take us, QE for the people instead of QE for the bankers. I just had an email exchange with Dr. Pippa Malgram the other day. She has a fantastic new book out called Signals. I haven't read it yet, but it really looks interesting because what she's essentially done is tried to take all of these complex topics about why the social entitlement system is broken and cannot possibly be repaired and so forth, and break it down and explain it in simple terms that anybody can understand. One of her contentions, though, is she thinks the next major round of QE will all be about military spending. And, you know, that's a particular viewpoint that I don't think anybody else is talking about right now. Maybe there's another one that's not military spending, that's something else. I think what investors should be doing is saying, the next time the Fed prints a whole bunch of money in order to respond to the economy, where is it really going to go? Stop assuming it's going to work the way it worked last time. Assume that it might be completely and totally different and start thinking about what the political pressures are, what the drivers are that are going to affect that decision. I think that certainly if Donald Trump is elected president, the idea of a bunch of QE going into military spending is very possible. I suppose with either Donald Trump or with Hillary Clinton, a big military spending campaign, as Pippa Malgram is forecasting, is entirely possible. But I think what investors should do is stop assuming that QE is going to save asset markets and start thinking about how it might come in a different form.
We've been talking with Dr. Malmgren, as Eric has suggested, and hopefully we can get her on the program in the future so that Eric and she can have this conversation and clear some of this up for us and what it might look like exactly if governments around the world start in unison ramping up military spending as a form of fiscal stimulus. That would really jive with what we've been talking about on the program a lot lately with a lot of our guests, which is when economic conditions continue to deteriorate, military solutions often emerge, as unfortunate and disastrous as those can end up being. It's an easy way out for politicians. Even though a lot of friction is going to be caused, it ends up becoming the path of least resistance from a political standpoint. So we'll look forward to having her on the program if she can give us some time in the future. But I think that's going to do it for us this week, folks. We've got another exciting guest coming on next week, Jack Schwager. Many of you guys will know him from his legendary series called Market Wizards. Really excited for that conversation. In the meantime, your subscriptions, your ratings, your reviews on iTunes have been massively helpful and overwhelmingly positive. We really appreciate them. Keep them coming. And follow us on Twitter at Macro Voices, where you can connect with us every day and talk about whatever's going on. Also, our forums at macrovoices.com is a great place. If Eric and I didn't cover something or something was unclear, I know Axel gave us a lot to digest today. Let's talk about it in the forums, and hopefully we can get everybody clear on Axel's perspective at the very least. So until next week, everybody, thanks for listening. Take care.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.